Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 37 of season 10 of Movie Minute, the daily podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Andy Golding of the Spoiler Podcast and a writer on Blueprint Review. Welcome back to the show, Andy.
Hello, Rob. Good to be back.
Yeah. I'm still reeling from your top 11 Walter Matthau performances, but that's good. It's a good thing to be reeling from.
I should probably remind listeners.
Yeah, that's fine.
I should probably remind listeners that was part of my hijacking of the podcast, and I will be hijacking this episode as well at some point with the line, "I'm taking your train."
Okay, well, I wonder if you're going to be able to think of 11 Robert Shaw movies to add to your list. Who knows? So minute 37 begins with James explaining his location and ends with Costello showing the internal infighting that's been going on. So we left things off yesterday with Patrolman James trying to give in a bit of a report, and Patron wants him to speak louder, and he's trying to keep as silent as possible here, and he basically responds. Patron says to him, "You got to speak up," and he goes, "I can't." He goes, "I'm only 20 yards away from the hijacked train," and then he goes, "They just shot him with a machine gun," and I don't know why Patron answers this way. He goes, "Is he dead?" Like, why would he ask that question? Like, does it make
a difference? I don't know, but it sets up James for a brilliant response.
Yes, it really does. But the question is just, it's just, I don't know. It's like, and okay, let's say the answer would be no. He's screaming in pain, Get an ambulance over. I mean, like, what? I don't know what other type of response, to this type of question you can give.
I can imagine doing the same though. You hear someone's been shot, it's a bit of a shock, and you don't quite fully process all the details. So you just want that confirmation, don't you? Even though he's told him it's with a machine gun, he's not going to be alive.
That's right. And he's also 20 yards away. So it's, does he see Kaz writhing on the ground, or not? That's the question here. And James then responds and goes, "Wouldn't you be lieutenant?" Again, it's a very strange kind of comment, especially given the time period, because this is mid 1970s. I mean, we have characters that have referenced Vietnam. Okay. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that probably Patrolman James was also in Vietnam. I could be wrong, but yeah. There is that possibility that he would have been drafted at the time. And because in this movie they throw out the term machine gun a little too much, making it seem as if there's this all being machine gun, nowadays even your average people know more about weapons than people probably did back then, but that has probably more to do with the internet and movies than anything else. But just to refer to it as a machine gun, I'm pretty sure that at some point maybe it was last week when Warren was giving his report over the phone. At least he says that terrorists have taken over a train with machine guns or something like that. I'm trying to remember who actually said it, but nowadays you wouldn't say it that way. So it's just very telling of the time that they would just refer to it as a machine gun.
Yeah.
So whatever. and what's Patron's response to that? He goes, "All right, stay put and keep an eye on things." Like, what else is he? What else is he going to do?
It's interesting because it's quite James's comment is quite flippant, and I love him for it. I love the character for his casual wit in the face of tragedy. But I hated Mr. Grey for the same thing in the last episode we listened to, his scoreboard comment. I guess being on the right side of the battle gives James the privilege to be flippant.
Yeah. Yeah, and then so he finishes his conversation with James, and then we're back with Patron, and you know, he turns on, he like puts the mic on the side, and then, you know, now talks through the switchboard to Garber, and he goes, "Z, they just drew first blood. That supervisor from Grand Central Tower, I don't know his name. They just killed him." And, you know, then we see Walter Matthau Garber's response to this whole thing. And we also see people in the background listening, which is also great. You know, they keep things very busy throughout every scene. You know, there's, especially when we're in the command center. The command center is still running the way it should. And one of the other things that I've pointed out many times, they're great here about the continuity, because you can see the clock, and the clock keeps moving. It's now 2:20 on the clock.
Yeah, it's a bold thing to do, to put that clock in there, isn't it? Because that's something you've got to keep. I suppose it enhances the film, because you can see the time all the time, but you've got to be very tight with continuity. Mm-hmm. It's like cigarettes are always one of the things that are the worst for continuity. You see them changing length all the time, because you can't get them to if you keep cutting, you've got to make sure they're smoked to the exact same point.
Correct. I actually used to get, you know, I love IMDb. I've loved IMDb for as long as it's been around, because, you know, I was one of, when I first started using internet in the mid-90s, they already, you know, I would always go to IMDb, the version of IMDb they had at the time, and I would always look at the goofs and the trivia and stuff like that. And once people started getting really into the whole continuity issue about cigarettes, that was something that actually turned me off about the goofs. You know, it's just like, come on, you know. You know, it's one thing if there's really cool trivia about a movie, and sometimes there are really big goofs that are fun to watch. But again, as you just pointed out, you know, the idea of a you know, a cigarette not being the same length, a clock being different, that is something else. You know, that,
yeah,
that they got to get right.
Yeah, but it's great to notice those things, because there's so many different roles go into making a great movie or even a bad one, and we tend to prioritize things like the director and the actors, but like the people who are making sure that continuity of that clock is right, they deserve credit as well.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember that in when we did Saving Private Ryan 2 seasons ago, you know, I noticed that after Vin Diesel's character was dead, they had a shot of the men walking through a field, and there was one extra guy there. Meaning that when they edited it, they didn't notice that they were using a shot that Vin Diesel was in, even though his character was dead. Exactly. How long was the cigarette? I don't know. Before or after he was dead? So he uses the term here, first blood. Do you have any idea when that phrase was originated?
Oof, no, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, the first I heard of it was the Rambo film, but obviously that came after this. I'm guessing it was in some kind of wartime or first blood.
Wouldn't it be cool if Stallone used the phrase because he saw it on Taking Power 1-2-3?
Well, you never know, do you?
Nope. And we never will.
No. I'm going to guess it was used in the early 1900s, maybe?
It started out in the mid-1500s.
Oh, a little way off then.
Yeah. So it was the literal sense of the term of first blood was the first physical wound drawn in a combat or a duel.
Yeah.
You know, back in the 1500s, that's when they had that. But you also have the idea of the metaphorical meaning. you know, the first advantage gained over an opponent in a competitive situation and things like that. And that was first used in around 1540.
I guess with my guess, I was severely underestimating the long and violent history of mankind.
Yes, that's true. You haven't watched enough Errol Flynn movies. Yeah. That should be the next list you have to do.
I do. I love Errol Flynn, actually.
I should be giving you assignments. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, so knowing the two meanings of it, you know, the physical meaning and the metaphorical meaning, I think they both fit here really well.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the physical aspect, okay, they've killed somebody. They've drawn blood, but the idea of an advantage being gained in a competition or conflict is just great, because what it basically means is that, you know, Blue and his men have now shown what they're willing to do, which means that's going to change the whole situation, because we now, you know, everyone needs to now take them seriously.
And so yeah, I didn't even notice that, but that's
they've gained an advantage in the negotiation, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's an example of just a really well written piece of dialogue. I find this minute is out of the 5 minutes that I looked at, this minute is my favorite, because I think I'll get into it more as we go along, but I think it's a great example of a well-written minute.
Because it is great, and we're not even halfway through it at this point.
No.
So what's very interesting though is that in the novel that this is based on, so the term First Blood does refer, you know, it is mentioned in the book, and it happens at this exact same time also.
Yeah.
You know, but it's slightly different. I mean, I'm just going to quickly read a little bit of what it says in the novel about this. And it's from the perspective of Mr. Green. Mr. Green goes, yeah. First Blood. That was the traditional railroad term describing the first time an engineer killed someone on the tracks. And Longman had applied it somewhat erroneously. He realized the Stever hitting the loudmouth Spade with his gun. He avoided looking at the victim sitting there and dabbing at his face with a bloody handkerchief, but out of sight was not quite out of mind, and his legs were still a little shaky. Stever's blow, so calmly delivered, tuned up his sense of disbelief again. Stever is Mr. Brown, but in the movie, it was Mr. Gray who hit the pimp, right? And he goes, how, if he could have in his right mind, could have Ryder ever have talked him into it? Ryder's Mr. Blue. How could he have let Ryder hypnotize him out of his living mind? But what was really happening? Had he meekly followed Ryder against his own will, standing here now at the front of the car with the submachine gun and alien weight in numb hands, sweating lightly but steadily under his mask? He admitted that he had not been so passive as he wanted to believe. In fact, he had cooperated eagerly, and he had been conning himself when he pretended that it was all fun and games, a running gag to divert them as they drank their weekly beer after the unemployment office. The truth was that Ryder was tacitly conceded, had tacitly conceded that the hijack was conceivable. What remained was whether or not it was workable. So again, here they're gonna the novel goes into how the friendship between Ryder and Longman, you know, Blue and Green, moved, you know, how it progressed over time. But it's just really interesting that the first blood instance is, you know, when they you know, when he hits the pimp in the face, and it's not when he, you know, later gets shot. But
yeah,
for the line of him talking about the fact that that's when an engineer killed someone on the tracks, and that's exactly what just happened. Gray killed someone on the tracks. So I do like that connection.
Yeah, no, that's, it's really nicely used. I haven't read the novel actually. Does it switch perspectives, or is it all from
It's
Mr. Green's
completely
perspective?
no, it's completely perspectives. Every
Oh.
sub part of the chapter is gives the different perspectives of the various characters,
Yeah, this is
which is
something
great.
that's well preserved in the film.
Yes, it is. I do like the way that they do that there. And then so Garber at this point is pretty shocked about the fact that that this has happened. I mean, it's also a nice way that they show that Patron doesn't know who Kaz is. He just knows that that there's a supervisor who was killed, and and he even says, "I don't know who the guy's name." And Garber then goes, "Oh my God." He goes, "Thanks, Rico." Garber then turns to Frank Grillo, and he says to him, "Frank, you know who went to the 28th from Grand Central?" He goes, "Yeah, Kaz Dalowitz. Why?" He goes, "Jeez, I knew him." "Hey, what do you mean you knew him?" "They just shot him." And again, he the delivery from Matthau is superb, the way that he does this.
Yeah.
He's been joking around and whatever, but here he's very, very sincere about this now that he realizes that, okay, this is a guy he knows. And then Carell says to him, "Dead? Kaz? At Kaz?" He goes, "Yeah." And as we're all trying to take in this whole moment, we hear on the radio, "Garber," and Carell goes, "Oh." And then we once again hear on the radio, "Garber, you're there? You're there, Zach?" And Garber then pushes the button and goes, "Yeah, who is this?" And he goes, "Costello." And he goes, "Yes, Captain." He goes, "I'm putting you in charge at this end. I'm going to headquarters. If I don't show up quick, the city cops will." And then he gets cut off with what he's trying to tell him. But first of all, I find it really interesting that the captain at this point is telling Garber that he's in charge. I mean, don't they already know that?
I think Garber seems to be put in charge of everything, doesn't he? He's got a show around the Japanese directors, and he's
He's an all-around guy.
yeah.
What's the phrase? I think in baseball the term is like a journeyman, like somebody who can play
Oh
all the positions, that type of thing.
yeah.
So you
That
can
was
be,
also
that's right. So he's a
just.
tour guide, and he's also in charge of taking care of this whole hostage situation, being the guy on the radio with them and stuff like that. I guess sort of a negotiator from that perspective. So yeah,
I think
it's just very funny the way that they talk about this. And one of the things also is that it's very interesting that Costello basically tells him and tells us that there's going to be so much politicking and infighting between the various branches of the New York Police Department, either wanting to take credit or wanting to stay away from or wanting to take credit and wanting not to take the blame, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Just by this little conversation where he goes, "I'm going to headquarters because if I don't show up quickly, the city cops, will do something," which people will have to wait until tomorrow to find out what he thinks they're going to do. But it is so descriptive and telling of what's going on here, and I really like that.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I really love about I love a lot about this minute, but I find it quite moving this minute, and I think it's a great example of showing and not telling, because I glean so much about Garber's and Frank's relationships with Kaz from so little. So you get that bit where Garber says, "Geez, I knew him," and you can see he's sad, but it's kind of tossed out, and he has to continue on with what he's doing. Whereas Frank is just gobsmacked, and he says, "Kaz, Fat Kaz," and it's that moment. I mean, I think some people pick that out, the Fat Kaz bit, as something that you wouldn't do nowadays. You wouldn't have that nickname, but I think it's a great piece of writing, because it shows, I can imagine Frank and Kaz as having been quite close buddies, and Fat Kaz, by the standards of the day, it feels like an affectionate nickname that would have been used between two old pals who struggle to express their tender sides in any kind of sincere way. So I get, just from that those small pieces of dialogue, I get this idea that Kaz meant quite a lot to Frank, and I mean, Dick O'Neill is brilliant in this scene as well, and I think you can see how Garber is able to, he acknowledges the tragedy, but he's able to move past it. With Frank, this death absolutely lights the touch paper on his subsequent response to the whole situation.
Now I'm going to go back again to the novel with this whole thing, because this is also great. There's great dialogue from Carell here when after they find out that Kaz was killed. And actually in the novel they say that his name is Casimir Dalowitz,
Oh.
Casimir. I've never heard that name before.
No. Casimir. I wonder what the origin of that is.
I don't know. We'll have to figure that out. We'll have to
Yeah.
look that up, because that's just it's a Polish name,
Oh.
and it means either proclaimer of peace or destroyer of peace.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it was a masculine name that was popular among Polish royalty. Interesting. And it comes from a Slavic term that means to preach or to proclaim. Interesting.
He certainly liked to do
Yes, that he did.
that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've ever heard the name used elsewhere besides here.
No, it doesn't ring a bell for me. Kaz, no.
Yeah. But so in the novel where Garber is a minor character. He's not even a major character. The main cop's name is Prescott. But they get into a little bit of an argument here, because it says there, from the farthest reaches of the command center, small groups of men were converging on Carell, who suddenly quieted and, collapsing in his chair again, began to sob. Then he goes, "Stay put, Clive," the captain said. "Maintain contact with the train until we work out some means of communication. Are they saying anything? They've been silent for the last few minutes. Tell them we reached the mayor. Tell them we need more time. Jesus, what a city. Any questions?" "Yes, I'd like to get in on the action." "That's not a question. Stay where you are." The captain hung up. The groups from the other parts of the command center, train masters and dispatchers of the other divisions had arrived, rolling cigars in their mouths. They surrounded the console and looked down dispassionately at Carell. Carell, whose moods Prescott had determined were intense but short-lived, abandoned tears in favor of pounding his desk in anger. "Gentlemen," Prescott said. "Gentlemen." Dozen faces turned towards him, cigars twitching in twin-lipped mouths. "Gentlemen, this desk is now in effect a police post, and I'll have to ask you to clear out." "Kaz is dead," Carell said tragically. "Struck down in his prime." "Gentlemen," Prescott said. "Fat Kaz has been taken away from us," Carell said. Prescott stared sternly at the group around the console. The blank faces returned his gaze, cigars rotating. And then, still expressionless, they began to drift away. Prescott said, "See if you can raise the train, Frank." Carell's mood shifted again. His wiry body stiffened, and he shouted, "I refuse to dirty my hands speaking to those black bastards." "How can you tell what color they are over the radio?" "Color? I mean black-hearted," Carell said blandly. "All right, let me sit down so I can work." Carell jumped to his feet. "How do you expect me to keep the line running if you take my console away?" And then they continue a little bit long with their argument. I'm not going to read the whole thing from that one, and then a little bit on, he goes, in another emotional quick change, Carell's eyes filled with tears. "Fat Kaz, a beautiful man, a white man." "You got a great touch with the language, Carell. Old Kaz, a railroad man in the old tradition." "Pat Burdick would have been proud of him." And he goes, "If he walked into those guns, he was stupid." "Who is Pat Burdick?" "Pat Burdick, a legend, the greatest of the old train masters. The stories about him, I could tell you a dozen." And he goes, "Some other time." And then they go, "Are you sure he's dead?" And then he goes, "Fat Kaz has been taken from us." Yeah, If anyone gets a chance, you should try and get a copy of the novel to read it. It's
Yeah, it sounds very good,
very
yeah.
fascinating to read, and especially when you know the movie, to see the differences and stuff like that. So I like the way they did that. Okay, so is there anything else you wanted to talk about with this particular minute?
Don't think so. I think we've covered it all now.
Okay, all right. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Blues Day Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five or possibly 10 Robert Shaw films performances. So, Andy, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, well, actually, I had a bit of trouble with this one because I thought, oh yeah, Robert Shaw films. I like Robert Shaw. I can do this. But I realised that a lot of the Robert Shaw films I'd seen, I actually wasn't that keen on, or he didn't give his best performances. So I've been watching a lot of Robert Shaw films recently, and I've managed to put together my top five. It's actually top six because I was going to leave Taking a Pelham out, but I am going to insert it in there now. So the one that got bumped was it's a little British B movie called Tomorrow at 10 by a director called Lance Comfort, in which Robert Shaw plays a kidnapper. He kidnaps a small child and he places him in a room with a bomb inside a stuffed toy. And the film is all about trying to work out where this child is. It's a good little film, and Robert Shaw is very good in it, but I think that is the one that's gonna have to go to get Pelham in there. So my number five then, the
I gotta
first one
tell you though
to slip in.
that sounds like a really, really interesting movie.
Oh, have you never seen it?
No,
Sorry, it surprises me when you haven't seen a film. It's
when you go really deep, but you see that because you've now mentioned that will be remedied by the time that this that these episodes air.
Well, hopefully you'll enjoy it as much as I did. My first film in top five then is Robin and Marian, the Richard Lester sort of post swashbuckler, in which Robert Shaw plays the Sheriff of Nottingham. I think it's a really interesting film that, and he makes a great villain, as we know. Well, as my
I'm
number
actually
four
not.
attests
I'm
as well,
actually
you can.
not the biggest fan of that movie.
Yeah, I remember seeing it for the first time and not really hitting big with me, but I've seen it a few times now and it grows for me each time. It's got a sort of a strange melancholy which really worked for me the more I watched it.
Okay.
My number four is one of the ones that almost everyone has, which is The Sting, again. Robert Shaw showing how he can play a great villain with what seems like minimal effort. I'm sure he's putting the effort in, but he slips into that role beautifully. My number three, I'm not going to be a contrarian. I'm gonna have Jaws in there, and Jaws is actually my number three.
Really, I'm
I
actually
mean,
shocked.
everyone's talked.
You are the first person that has not put it at your number one.
Oh really? Has everyone else had Jaws as number one? I think it is a fantastic performance, and but I had to put this one above it. I've put Taking a Pelham at number two. I think he's great in this film, and it's a different. Jaws is a bigger performance. I think Taking a Pelham is a more controlled performance. But my number one is there's a couple of Harold Pinter adaptations that starred Robert Shaw. One of them is William Friedkin's The Birthday Party, which I found virtually impenetrable. And the other one is Clive Donner's The Caretaker, which I loved. And Robert Shaw is brilliant in it. He delivers a monologue in this film, which is I think it's up there with the Jaws monologue. It's great. He plays a character where you can see there's something not quite right about him, and it takes a while of the film, but he gets to a point where he delivers a monologue where he explains the reason behind that, and that scene alone was just enough for me to put this performance as my number one.
Interesting. Okay. That is a very, very interesting. That's a nice choice. I saw a movie recently called The Caretakers, but I don't think it's the same one. It was
Was that the caretakers plural these days?
yes, the one I saw was plural.
Yeah, this is just The Caretaker.
When did that come out?
1963, and it co-stars Alan Bates and Donald Pleasance, so the other two
Is it
actors.
maybe called The Guest?
The Guest, that's right. It's also known as The Guest, yeah.
Okay.
It's The Caretaker, yeah, it's also known as The Guest, that's right.
Okay. That's actually a very scary poster of someone who looks like they're either laughing or I can't even tell. Yeah, it's also known as The Caretaker. You're right. There you go. So you see, you found another movie I haven't seen.
Oh right. Oh well, there's two on that list then. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. I know where we're going next is the daily remake question. So at this point, I'm going to say I'm taking your train, Rob, because after my question, I've got a remake question for you as well.
Okay. So every day we have a game called Name That Remake, where my guest will have to try to guess a remake based on small little clues. I'm going to tell you the year that the movie original movie came out, the year the remake came out, and you're going to get a brief synopsis of the movie. And this is being done randomly, so I do not know what movie you're going to get, and I'm going to spin the wheel, and we'll see what movie Andy gets. Which remake does he get? And the wheel goes around and around and around and around. Okay. An injured police officer is used by a corporation in order to try to change the way people look at fighting crime. The original movie came out in 1987 and the remake in 2014.
87, 2014. Right. Is it RoboCop?
Yes, it is. Very good.
That took a second, but I got there. Right. The one I've got for you, I don't know if it will be on your list, but I chose it especially because it's a remake which not many people seem to realize is a remake. And I thought if anyone's going to get the answer to this, it'll be Rob. So the original came out in 1935 and the remake was in 1959. And it's two unemployed musicians resort to desperate measures in order to join a traveling band.
Okay, so obviously it's Some Like You Hot is the one from
Yeah.
1959. Is it was the original also called Some Like It Hot?
It was called Fanfare of Love, the original.
Okay.
35. It's just it was something that I didn't know for many years that Some Like It Hot was actually a remake. So
Well, it's not on my list, so it was something I was not aware of either.
good, good. I've never seen Fanfare of Love, but
No, neither have I.
it's one of my big controversies though, is that I don't dislike Some Like It Hot, but I don't think it's one of the great American films like most other people do. It's not one of my favorites.
Okay, well, first of all, Fanfare of Love, from what I see, is a French movie.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yes. Okay, so it's you see that's one of the big questions, and I've had some of the remakes that on the list for the Name That Remake that were movies that were originally in a different language that were eventually done in English and things like that. But the question is when if you're ch what do you consider a remake? Is a remake when you take something and change the language and transform it into in a English language movie, is that considered the same type of remake as something that is just rehashed? Like taking
I
Ballet
don't
1 2
know.
3.
It's
as you know, as a perfect example. You have this idea. Okay, let's take this idea and let's tweak it a little bit here and there, and hopefully it'll come out better, but usually it doesn't. But when you're dealing with the foreign language aspect of it, so you're taking something like Infernal Affairs, okay, and you're saying, wow, this is a great idea. I'm Martin Scorsese. I'm going to take this and I'm going to make a Oscar-winning, Best Picture-winning story out of it, by turning it into, The Departed. So
Yes.
I see. I tend to like those type of remakes better than ones that are just rehashing the old plot.
Yeah, there's other kinds as well. I seem to remember when the Coen brothers' True Grit came out, I think they said it's not a remake of the 60s film. We've gone back to the source material, so it's just a different. But then someone pointed out that the eye patch that Rooster Cogburn wears is not referred to in the source material, so they at least took something from the there's elements of elements of remake. It was in their heads when they remade it. So,
Oops.
but then, I mean, if you it's different. I mean, obviously, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films aren't a remake of Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings film. So when there's a source novel, I suppose that's a whole other wild card.
Interesting. But again, is that a remake? Because again, it's using the source material. And I mean, when you bring up the Lord of the Rings, the Peter Jackson version goes into much more detail than the Bakshi stuff did. Even though I like the Bakshi stuff, I think those are fun movies. They are more for kids than for adults, but it's still interesting.
I suppose the name is, when people say remake, I assume it means you say it's a remake of that film, whereas, but then could it be a remake of the same material? Oh, I don't know. We need to look up the origin of the term remake and find out exactly what it means and what date it was first used. I'm going to guess the 1500s.
No idea.
Yes,
No idea.
please.
No idea. All right. On that note, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Andy Goldman?
Yeah, sure. You can find all the episodes of the now defunct Spoiler Podcast that I was part of at spoilerpodcast.podbean.com, and you can find my writing about films on blueprintreview.co.uk.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram, and you can find me on Facebook. So until tomorrow, shoo!
Because I'm tight.